This program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7, your community radio here in Portland, Oregon. The time right now is 7:37 in the morning. Today is a Monday, the 20th of February, and my name is Chris Andre. In just a moment this morning, we're going to be joined by Peter Schoonmaker. He is the guiding light of the Ilahi Institute, which is a consulting and research branch of Ilahi. The Institute and Ilahi Foundation provide information, analysis that are critical to responsible environmental stewardship. Some of the areas that Ilahi is active in are watershed assessment, sustainability indicators, landscape history, environmental reviews, vegetation assessment, wetland delineations, wildlife assessment, environmental assessment, city, county, state, and federal permit assistance, and bioregional resource assessment. Just a moment ago, before we got rolling with this program today, we heard a little bit from Cedar Moon. It's Night Music of the Native American Flute. It's by Jeff Barr. So we had a little bit of that, and now we're going to have a little bit of talking. My guest, Peter Schoonmaker of Illihi, is here with us this morning, and Illihi has a new lecture series, which I believe that KBOO listeners will be familiar with. If not, I'm sure that Peter can tell you all a little bit about it. Good morning, Peter, and welcome to KBOO.
Good morning, Chris.
Tell us a little, before we start talking, I know that on the 24th, the petroleum geologist Kenneth DeFays is going to be speaking on Peak Oil, Hubbert's Peak. A lot of listeners to KBOO are familiar with Mr. DeFays' book. He's someone that I think we're going to be hearing a lot more about these ideas, and they're rather beyond predictions at this moment, right, Peter?
That's right. Ken, in his most recent, just a quick background on Ken DeFays. He's born in an oil patch, and got all his degrees from a good geology school, Colorado School of Mines, and then went on to work for Shell Oil, and then become a professor at Princeton University, and retired about 6 years ago. And Ken worked with a guy at Shell Oil who, back in the 50s, predicted that the U.S. Production of oil would peak in 1970, and he was derided, a guy named King Hubbert. He was derided by everybody in the industry, and then turned out he was right. And then he also predicted that worldwide production of oil would peak sometime around the year 2000, or at least in this decade. And turns out he's right. And Ken recently just wrote something on his webpage saying that, well, I've ceased
three
to
weeks.
Become... Yeah, said 3 weeks ago, said, I've ceased to become a prognosticator. I'm now an historian. We peaked in oil production on December 16th, 2005. And there's a lot of ramifications for our oil-dependent society and world.
It's going to definitely change a lot of the parameters that we're familiar with in Oregon, even though Oregon is not a gigantic oil-producing area. This is going to have ramifications throughout the world. We already, I think, see, for example, in Nigeria, there are 9 hostages taken because people are tired of having... their land despoiled by this industry. So we're already seeing a lot of political unrest. So there are social implications to peak oil as well. The Illihi Institute, let's talk a little bit about that. Tell the listeners, if you would, please, more about what the Illihi Institute is all about.
Well, I guess, to a certain degree, we're perhaps a live version of KBOO, in that we don't necessarily push one agenda or another. We're focused on to a large degree environmental issues, but we have had to branch out from there because environmental issues are so interconnected with everything else. Our marquee program is this the Illihi Lecture Series. Last year we did a series on how cities learn, kind of the evolution and development of urban civilizations. So each year we do this lecture series that's kind of around a theme or a topic. This year, and each year it's around a question. The question last year was, how do cities learn? How do they evolve? This year, it's around, the question was, what are some of the most important resources in the world that are going to kind of shape our future? And so we ask, what might those be? Would they be potatoes or oysters or, forest products? And none of those really came up to the top. And it was, it was really oil and water were the two key ones that we thought we'd have to worry about. So our nature is to ask questions as versus say that, you know, the answer is such and such. The answers kind of come out of the questions that we ask through the lecture series.
So it's kind of like ethnogeology in a way,
yeah.
The way people interact with resources in the earth. Elihi means, I believe, I got this off of the Elihi website, mm-hmm. It earth, ground, land, country, place, or world. In each respect, I think that the Kenneth DeFay lecture is going to be very interesting. Tell us, take us like 5 years, 10 years down the pike in Oregon as oil reserves dwindle. The cost of oil goes up, people's behavior changes, all kinds of patterns at work, living, obviously travel. What do you see, how do you see Oregon managing to evolve or adapt to changing conditions?
It's hard to predict. Right now, just as background, produce about as much power from hydroelectricity in the Northwest as we do from consuming petroleum. That's not the case for a lot of other places in the United States. So to a certain degree, we're in pretty good shape because of the hydro, because we have ample food sources here in the Willamette Valley and the Puget Trough. But Ken DeFays and our previous speaker, Jim Kunstler, are saying, life is going to be very, very different. It's going to be much more local. I think to a certain degree here in the Northwest, we're prepared for that because we're already thinking that way. There's a lot of people that are thinking about kind of localizing our economies, and quite apart from, issue of peak oil. And when the peak oil issue came along, a lot of the people that are kind of going local said, well, that'll work for us. So, for the people that are prepared for this kind of mentally, I think it's going to be tough for everybody. I think it's going to be wrenching. And the problem is that so few of our business and political leaders are clued into this at all. So it's going to be shocking for this. I think it'll be something like, I've forgotten what the 12 steps for, Alcoholics Anonymous are. What's the first thing? Anger, denial, I forget. But we're going to go through, we're, as our fearless leader George Bush says, we're addicted to oil, no kidding. And so, what are those steps that happen to an addict that they have to go through? It's not fun.
No, it's going to be painful for everyone. I wonder about thinking about Oregon as an organic whole, as a part of a greater world. After Katrina, there are a lot of people who are displaced, and it's tempting to imagine that with the familiar world changing so much, this is very frightening to many people, and perhaps more so to people who don't understand it, who haven't taken a look at some of these things, taken a good hard look at peak oil, taken a good hard look at how we're damaging our water resources and how water itself is becoming more and more a valuable commodity. When catastrophes like Katrina send large populations into motion, so we actually have sort of within the United States now, a huge refugee population, there are going to be, I can't help but think, in the future, possibly mass migrations of people who are set on the move because, for one reason or another, their homes, their livelihoods have been lost, and they've been forced to relocate, and there may be fewer and fewer places to relocate too. So I think that peak oil, and this is why I'm very interested to see what Kenneth DeFays has to say on the 24th, seems to me that there are going to be some very challenging social situations to look at. It'll be possibly rather like some of the situations that we see in sub-Saharan Africa, for that matter, Sahara in Africa, as a matter of fact, thinking about, well, what's going on? There's a terrible drought right now in Somalia, largely brought about by changing weather patterns. And I think that, what do you think, Peter? Weather is going to play, come into the picture too, eh?
Yeah, well, oil, and one of the reasons we, you know, that oil and water kind of works out as a, you know, kind of lecture theme and as a kind of something to think about is that they're so interconnected. So we're burning all this oil, we're changing our atmosphere, we're changing weather patterns, we're likely in 50 years to not have the same snowpack that we have up in the Cascades. The Southwest, who knows what's going to happen with kind of the Sun Belt where all these people have migrated to, and they don't have the resources to support themselves. I didn't want to get quite into this so soon, but you look at what will happen with water, and I think essentially, you know, the bottom line is that with you know, the decline in petroleum and the inability for basically the vast sprawling suburbs that we've mistakenly engineered in the Southwest and Southern California, that people won't be able to drive, you know, 100 miles round trip to their jobs, and plus their water tables are 500 feet below the ground. Anybody with any sense down there in the next quarter or half century is going to move. They're going to leave. And one of the kind of most pleasant places to live in the world is, well, we're sitting here, and I would expect a lot of people to move to the nicer places where you can produce your own food, where there's an equable climate, where you don't have summers with 115 degree days. And it's one of those kind of, you know, outside exogenous forces that, again, our business and political leaders, we have kind of these models of how Portland is going to look and how the Willamette Valley is going to look in the next 50 years. And I say, you know, throw that out the window, because, you know, there's a big change coming and we're not prepared and thinking about it at all.
That's why it's so interesting to me anyway, to try to factor the last Elihi lecture series in with this one, because oil and water are definitely going to play a role in how cities learn. It's like kind of like the Elihi Institute is building a greater theme from year to year with the series, putting information out there for people and making it available, bringing people like DeFaze to Portland, where you can hear him firsthand explain the situation, which, as it turns out, really is evolving quite a bit more quickly than people had imagined. It's difficult to stay current with these things, it seems to me.
It is, and what's remarkable to me is that we'll really know this is for real when the knuckleheads on Wall Street wake up and panic. It's funny, this the idea of peak oil anyway has been around for 50 years. The idea of kind of the legitimacy that this could happen globally has been around for a couple of decades. But it's much like global warming, which was really a discussion between a bunch of pointy-head scientists, you know, back in the 60s and 70s and up through the mid-80s before it broke out, before really Bill McKibben broke it out in his book End of Nature. So it's not that the ideas are really kind of being debated among people that know what they're talking about. It's, you know, getting kind of the clueless, the vast kind of, and that's not the American public, it's the media and, the financiers and leaders to clue into this. And they, you know, by and large, always clue in far too late to, you know, be very helpful.
Yeah, I think the status quo is a very comfortable place.
Yeah.
I think, though, that maybe some of the fringe areas of investment, such as looking at what hedge fund managers do and what gold funds do too, is you can start to see a little flutter of panic ripple through that industry. I know that possibly investment is not that important to some KBOO listeners, but I know that a lot of you out there are well aware that if you want to figure out what's going on, follow the money. And I think as we watch the price of oil edge ever upward, that's even better advice than before. It's one way of it's a predictor of what goes on in the world. I'd like to ask Richard, our engineer, if he would please we'd like to invite people to call in. If there are any listeners who would like to call in and if you've got a question or a comment, if you'd like to ask Peter Schoonmaker of the Illihi Institute another question. First, I want to tell you, though, that you're listening to KBOO 90.7 in Portland, and the time right now is 7:53 in the a.m. on Monday, February 20th. I'm Chris Andre. My guest today is Peter Schoonmaker. So, do we have a call yet? Okay, caller, good morning.
Hi.
Good morning.
Well, I'm waiting for the hysteria to set in, and I've been actually in school in the 50s. This was being discussed in my classes on urban design, and of course, those concerns never radiated out into the public. It was never communicated. But what really surprises me is no one talks about the fact that the cities as they came to be in the 20th century really are the anomalies of history, and that aren't sustainable in any when looked at through the prisms that have been shaped for us by the people who have considered all the data and just the mathematics of it. And also, there seems to be a presumption out there that really comes from a lot of by urban designers, that all of this is manageable. I mean, that it's going to be very neat and manageable. But, I mean, if we look at the economic migrations that are taking place now, how manageable has that been? And how fast has society been able to trim its views and comprehension of what's taking place to be able to deal with that in a manageable way? And I'm waiting for the hysteria to set in. But it seems like right now we're masking the reality that the cities aren't sustainable. And that, and I'm glad you brought up the issue of mass migrations, because those things, as they will take place, will really collapse the infrastructure that we have in place for managing those migrations, unless we really leap to extremes of planning, which will really deny us the options we've had in the past. I mean, we might have to really say we're going to have closed borders, we're going to have this or that, because if we look at what the Stanford's Department of Demographics tells us, that these migrations are really just going to completely overwhelm environments, collapse the available resources in terms of fallback resources like wildlife, fish, all of that. So, thank you.
How exactly, caller, are you still on the line? How exactly would you close borders under that, what would presumably be crisis conditions?
Well, I mean, the point is if you look at the whole, take into view the whole spectrum of what is taking place and how in the 20th century we simply overpopulated, and that's something that no one really wants to discuss, and the grim realities of what happens when there aren't sufficient resources to accommodate all the people there are. I mean, that is just really an ugly picture that no one wants to look at. But what do you do? I mean, for instance, in the 30s in America, where there were plenty of fallback resources such as wildlife, fish, people were not as concentrated into population. I mean, into urban areas. People got by gardening, fishing, and hunting.
Good point.
The point is that. Those fallback resources are already greatly diminished. If you actually, if 17% of the population in this country now tried to get by on, as people got by during the 30s when there were no safety nets in society, that the resources would be completely gleaned in no time.
That's probably true. Caller, just one moment. We've got a few other callers.
Did you have
a question or anything for Peter Schoonmaker?
Well, it seems like still we talk about it much like I hear urban planners talk about that. Oh, well, if we just design communities properly, you know, and everybody doesn't rinse out their toothbrush as often as they do now, that, oh, we can manage. And I'm just saying that, you know, if you look, you know, they're always talking about, the, you know, managed projections of population. And just as you pointed out, the migrations of populations are going to be completely unmanageable.
Thank you so much, caller. I appreciate your comments. Thanks. I think we do have another caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Well, I just want to say I may accidentally cut us off because I got a defective telephone wire, but I'll go ahead. Hello?
Yes.
Okay. This may not be important to the bigger issue, but I found out something recently locally, a couple of things, like some man owns some property in Troutdale, and there's waterfalls on it, and I think it's a natural waterfall.
Yes.
And then I don't know whether this may not be accurate or not, but I was interested in this Willamette Falls. I don't know whether it exists anymore in Oregon City or area, but apparently, and this may not be correct, some paper company owns it or has it. So anyway, I am just those what appear to be smaller things. I am blank pissed about that. But I want to, getting back to this refugee thing, I've been feeling like one since the 80s, and I guess a lot of other people, without going through a Katrina, there's been no village or I guess you call family or friends there. I've started with divorce, lost health, income, and family, and then now my daughter in the 90s, more complicated, and her children with domestic violence, and no village there for us. So we're feeling like refugees without Katrina. Thank you.
Thanks for your call. About the waterfalls in Troutdale, I imagine, in Oregon City, the Willamette Falls, yes.
Yeah, I mean, there is a paper company that uses the Willamette Falls, but there's a power generating station there. I'll take those last two calls as questions in the sense that, are our political leaders and elected leaders kind of aware and doing anything about this? And I'd have to say around here, some of them, yeah. I think the Metro Council is generally aware of the situation and worried about it. Rex Burkholder is pretty much all over it. Earl Blumenauer picked up a brochure off of his staff's desk. Actually, Blumenauer signed up for the lecture series and then called up about a week before Kunstler came and said, this is really important. My staff is all over that. Well, we're worried about this peak oil issue. Roscoe Bartlett, who's a congressman in Maryland, is worried about it. So there are elected leaders around, not the majority of them. It's still a small minority, but they're they're aware of it. They're worried about it. They're proposing things. Oregon Department of Transportation actually has some language in their kind of their long-term vision that talks about we're not going to be burning oil like we are now. So it's out there, but it's not really still in the kind of a central issue, which I think it should be.
I think it's rather, heart-stoppingly alarming to publicly elected officials, and they are probably aware of it, but not ready to acknowledge it. Did we have another call? Okay, we do have another call. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. How you doing?
We're doing wonderfully well. Thanks a lot.
All right. So I've got kind of an echo on my phone here, so if I sound kind of confused, it's because I'm hearing my voice coming back to me.
Oh, okay.
So, I guess what I'd like to, I don't know if it's a comment or a question, but, the end result of, overpopulation and overconsumption, of course, is, economic collapse. And I just wonder, has the speaker ever heard of the website called diop.org, D-I-E-O-F?
I've been reading Diop since about 1999. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
it's a great.
I hate it. Depresses me, of course.
Of course it's depressing, but I mean, it's basically written by a bunch of, it gathers a bunch of information from ecologists who are very, and I'll admit to being an ecologist in the sense of that's my academic training. And so it's cold and
sobering,
but it treats humans like other animals, except that we have a conscience and that's about it. And a lot of people would say that other animals have a conscience too, but it's just a very, ecology is the study of the, distribution and abundance of organisms in their environment, period. And so it just treats humans like another one of those organisms. And it says, well, you know, that human populations are in for a collapse, and that's not going to be, it's never fun to be part of a collapse. Mm-hmm. It's always fun to be part of an increase, but being part of a population collapse is painful, and that's the case that dieoff.com makes.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what that brings me to is, you know, how do I explain to my friends who think that because they're the top of the food chain that they're invulnerable, and that they believe that they will, if there is a cataclysm that's going to happen, that they will survive. And it made me think of population dynamics, where the final species to fill the collapse, of course, is the predator species. And all of the red meat Republicans are always talking about, we've got the guns, we've got the tanks, we're big, we're strong, just like the ultimate predator. And what strikes me is that the way that predators always die out is through disease and starvation. And I just wonder, is when the...
Don't hang up, caller. I just need to quickly ID the station. Stay on the line and hold that thought, and we'll get right back to you. It's 8:04 a.m. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. And I'm Chris Andre. My guest this morning is Peter Schoonmaker from the Illahi Institute. Okay, caller, go ahead.
So my question is, as we see the population collapse, who do you see as being the survivors, the people high on the food chain or low on the food chain? And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay, well, that's assuming that, you know, we're having this is a fun morning. You know, disease, destruction, war, red meat. Again, that's hard to predict. When you look in nature and see kind of the resources decline, everyone gets hit. There isn't, because, you know, everything's interconnected. So, the organisms on the low end of the food chain, middle and on up through the top, is basically everyone gets hit. And as far as who survives, I think, you know, it's probably random. And you don't even know what kind of those kind of skills that are kind of pre-adapted to survival in that kind of situation are going to be. I must say that, you know, as bleak as this sounds, there's also, you know, here locally, there's some, you know, hopeful things going on, so that, you know, people are thinking about this, and there's little pods of people all around the country that are thinking about this. So here in Portland, there's Portland Peak Oil, and I think you can just go to, you know, portlandpeakoil.org, and they meet every Wednesday at 7 p.m. over at St. Francis Church. There's the Living Earth Gatherings that meets weekly, and they have these kind of talking circles. And again, you can go to livingearthgatherings.org, and they've been talking about basically powering down, about Richard Heinberg's kind of concept of powering down in a kind of a stepwise and rational fashion, rather than kind of doing it through panic and martial law and kind of, you know, the very worst way that we could do this. And it's probably going to be if what people that are thinking about peak oil are right, because it's going to require us to localize, probably a lot of the solutions are going to come locally, and the communities that are more prepared at a local and regional level to take care of themselves and kind of build strong neighborhoods and neighbors and relationships, and kind of create kind of a local and regional safety net, are the ones that are going to do better than the ones that just panic. So, for example, Jim Kunstler says he's really worried about the Southeast, where, it's God and guns. And, there's kind of he paints a broad brush and says there's a lot of the character of that part of the country, plus 100 degree temperatures, he thinks anyway, is makes it a bleak future. Likewise, with
it's a bleak present.
depending on where you are, yeah. Of many of the places in the U.S., I think Kunstler says that the Northwest, and of the big cities in the in the country, Portland are probably better off than most places around the country. Still, it's going to be, I think, you know, it's going to be a wrenching change that we're going to see.
I picture a number of scenarios. None of them are are very good, but it's all challenging. It's kind of an exciting time to be alive, actually. Yes, I believe we've got another caller on the line. Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Well, hey, Chris. How are you?
Hi. Good morning.
Oh, this is LJ. How you been?
very good. We're good.
We're here. It's Monday.
Okay, groovy. Okay. All right. Number one, ExxonMobil made $36 billion in profit last year.
Yeah.
Right, we're writing a letter to them asking them for a little support for the lecture series. We think they ought to give us like a, you know, maybe a million or two, just a better use than to like hire thugs in Nigeria. But
we're going to send them a KBU T-shirt.
Yeah.
They'll give it to you, all right, but they're not going to give you any money. All right. Number two, Halliburton made more money last year than it has in its 85-year history. Right.
That's called war profiteering. There's a name for that.
No kidding. But the fact is, Chris, that Halliburton and Kellogg Brown and Root, according to what I've been reading, will soon split. And now Halliburton stock that's trading at $80 will soon shoot up to $100. So do you think that the profit motive might have something to do with all of this? And how much money corporate America can extract out of us before we die?
Well, they seem to be bailing as fast as they can. Peter, go ahead.
It's something that's, you know, really kind of completely out of my expertise. So, I can only speculate that clearly the folks that are on Dick Cheney's energy council, which include people from Halliburton, Kellogg, Root & Brown, all the energy companies, whatever, they know this is coming. And, you know, Matt Simmons, who wrote Twilight in the Desert, he briefed the vice president and their council on peak oil back whenever it was in 2001, and he's been talking about it. So all these guys know this is coming. So if you did know this was coming and your motive is basically, you know, to, as with any system, to increase, you know, kind of the wealth of your system, what would you do? You'd try and make hay while the sun is shining. So, you know, to that degree, I agree with you that what you try and do is acquire as much wealth as you can and hoard it before, your business basically runs out of stuff to sell. And these guys are going to run out of oil to sell, and they've got to, you know, make their money now.
You bet. Just one more thing. All right. And then I'll get off the air. Once you take the ability away for people to feed themselves, which is exactly what's going on, right, the corporate farmers who sell you the food that's probably getting you sick will also be more than happy to sell you the drugs so you can go for the cure. So I have to remind my friends to raise as much of your own food as you can. And please, please, please vote with your dollars. And please, please, please keep the money in the loop. Have a nice day.
Thanks very much.
Bye, Chris Caller.
Yeah. It seems that's always the case, isn't it? It's like disasters, crises. Good for business, isn't it?
Yeah, there's always, you know, what's that? I think it's an apocryphal saying, you know, the sign for opportunity is like disaster and crisis.
Yeah.
Yeah. There'll be a lot of people that do, well, not a lot, but there'll be a certain number of people that do quite well in this that are, you know, sharp and quick and take advantage of people's fears and needs. That does bring out the worst in a minority of people, and they end up being Halliburton.
Yeah. Did we have another caller, Richard? Yes. Good morning, caller.
Hello.
Good morning.
Yeah. The thing that I haven't heard mentioned yet is how authoritarian governments that are tied up in wars react to these kinds of situations. And the two really awful examples are Cambodia and Germany.
I'm struggling against the cable headphones. Could you say that last bit again, please?
Cambodia and Germany.
Uh huh.
Mm-hmm. Are examples of authoritarian governments in wars that have found themselves dealing with food collapses.
Right. This is, Kunstler speaks to that. The question being, you know, what about when you have these kind of dire situations and people panic? Is you have people actually demand almost an authoritarian leader. They demand to be led. If you have somebody like Franklin D. Roosevelt, you're in pretty good shape. And if you have somebody like George Bush, you're in pretty bad shape. And not that, you know, probably in compared to authoritarian leaders, George W. Bush is not really that bad. He's just incompetent, compared to, say, somebody really awful like, Hitler or, one of those really terrible ones. So that's the problem is that, you know, as people panic, we may actually demand, something really bad for us, an authoritarian leader. And the fear is that somebody, you know, far worse than anybody we've seen in the United States rises up and takes on that role. Yeah. And we're really in trouble then.
The optimistic example is FDR. And part of the trip was that he still had the resources to vote with.
Right.
Yeah. And if there isn't enough to spread around, that kind of eliminates that kind of possibility.
Right. And even if you did have enough resources, there was a lot of people back in the 30s that really didn't like FDR at all.
The greedy capitalists that are saved from their own greed, thought it was the Antichrist. My grandfather, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's another dynamic again that we don't know how this is going to play out with I think it's very likely mass migrations at kind of a if not a collapse, a radical change in our economy, a more localized regional economy anyway. What's going to happen to companies and the people that work for them that are dependent on global trade?
Yeah.
Do we have a strong authoritarian leader, or does kind of the central government of the United States take on a less important role just because it can't do that much for people at a local and regional level? These are, huge uncertainties that it's really, really hard to predict. Best you can do is maybe look at pathways.
If a whole lot of people stay in denial and follow the government into these wars to run all over the world to steal what little bit of oil is left.
Mm-hmm.
That's about as awful as it can get, ultimately.
I think you're right, caller.
Thanks very much for your call.
Okay.
We've got one other caller. Thank you very much.
Sorry about that.
Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Good morning. So I just turned in just a little bit ago, and
our guest this morning is Peter Schoonmaker of the Illihi Institute, and we are talking about a lot of different things, as you probably noticed.
Right. I heard him say something about how, people are going to go, when peak oil hits and, the lowest of the lowest are getting hit first, which is me, of course, one of them. So we're the lower class and the poor start getting hit first, and then it goes up the chain. But as money becomes valueless, especially the dollar, as Iran goes to euro next month or sooner, and so you'll see a lot more people suffering. But you've got to start. I would think that we have to start. We've already started gathering as people, peak oil, Portland peak oil, and all these things are starting to make things more aware. But you got to start doing things for yourself and becoming third world. You have to. You guys just said, who's going to survive this? The people that have nothing already will survive this. The people that are third and fourth world don't have what we have, so they won't even feel.
In terms of sheer survival skills.
Well, in survival skills, and India and Africa, they have nothing. They've been living with nothing. So we live with everything, and when we get reprogrammed into having to live on Betty Crocker and Kraft macaroni and cheese, well, all these people that have been digging and getting and roots and eating grubs and doing all these things in the third world just to survive, you're going to see these people here freak out, and they're going to start killing each other, and they're going to say, they're going to kind of do their thumb, and they're going to go, brr, 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 what do I do? Where do I go? And it's the people that are taking steps in learning how to make flour, how to recognize plants and how to recognize roots and fresh water. And it's really the water that we're going to have to deal with. You can always live on grass, pretty much, but it's the water and defending yourself. So the people that are living the third world life are the people that will probably survive a little longer. But really, when it comes down to it, you have this mass die-off. So what are you going to do with the disease from the die-off? And that's what's going to hurt people.
Well, I think there's, there's multiple kind of possible future scenarios, and one of them is absolute disaster panic. But there's, and the other is, bingo, a miracle occurs. And that's what you're told by kind of the techno-optimists is that, oh, we're so inventive, we'll invent our way out of this mess.
Technology will save us.
And, I don't really buy into, either of those two extremes. I don't think it'll also be something in the middle. It's just really hard to predict, but, there's probably, dozens of possible pathways that we can go that kind of certain nick points in the future can push us one way or the other. And you
want to be careful not to manifest your reality either.
Yeah.
You don't want to manifest your third world existence.
You don't want to
manifest not having food, because if you put that energy out, it always comes back and you will end up having to live your words.
Yeah. But I think that you're in terms of like who, potentially can survive a catastrophe, it is going to be people that are kind of living with less, used to living with less, and do things for themselves. So,
right.
Notwithstanding that, the polar ice cap is going to disappear. Inuit cultures along the north of the continent are going to do quite well because. Or could potentially do quite well because everybody there knows how to do. There's no kind of specialization. You know how to hunt, survive. Kids are taught all the skill sets, not just like how to trade commodities or how to teach fourth grade math.
Right.
Presumably they will be able to adapt and say, okay, we don't have any polar bears anymore, but we can hunt something else and we'll figure it out somehow because they have such a complete kind of toolkit of survival skills, and the same with people living close to the land all over the world. They'll make it. People that really only know how to put like one widget into another, and that's what they do for 8 hours a day, they got problems.
Like the people who work at Tillamook Cheese, they sit at that conveyor belt, watch the cheese go by, and they fill the empty hole. It's like, it's still a job, but it's mindless.
Right.
So what we need to do is we need to start strengthening the mind. We need to start stepping out on our own. And there's opportunities to buy individual solar systems. I've got a little 80-watt solar system that does a 12-volt battery, and I walk around the house at night and I light up individual rooms that we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a 12-volt battery, and you go out and you charge it back up, and away you go. And you got to start learning how to filter your water. There's steps that we need to start taking to be self-efficient, because mm-hmm. when things get out of touch, get out of our reach, we need to start fending for ourselves no matter what, because just the economy is just going that direction anyway. So the less money you have, the more you need. And now it's really, here's the one thing is we can't, this is part of the four agreements. You cannot make assumptions without factual information. Assumptions is what damages you, because you are making an assumption on nothing other than, just making the assumption. There's nothing concrete there for that. So we must live in the now, in the present, and realize the steps that we must take to be self-sufficient on our own and gather our community. And my last thing, and I'll get off the phone, the CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil before he retired 6 months ago, he was on the TV a year ago, and I watched him on OPB. He said, and he looked right in the screen, Richard is his name, he says, by 2010, you will not drive 5 miles to work. You will not drive 5 miles to work, and the only way you're going to survive is if you live in tribal communities. And this is the CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil last year said this. I remembered it ingrained in my subconscious. And then he was forced out 6 months later as a forceful retirement. So what he was doing is he was cleaning his conscience, saying, oh, I told everybody, and then he left. So if the CEO and chairman of ExxonMobil says he will not drive 5 miles to work by 2010, I don't think we will, because he goes, we know what's happening 30 years from now, 30 years ago. So 30 years ago, we know what was happening today, and we know what's going to happen 30 years from now, because the oil companies don't go 5 years. They're looking big time in the future. So remember that, and just start learning to live efficiently and self-sufficiently and quit wasting, and take care and good show.
Thank you, caller. Do you have a, Peter, do you have a response to caller? We've got another caller on the line. We could take another call.
Sobering thought, and yeah, I'd like a follow-up question with the CEO of ExxonMobil.
How are you doing?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hello?
Yes, good morning.
I'd like to give you two monkey see, monkey do things that happen, and I want to ask a question. On the BBC, just I heard the U.S. ambassador to Iraq said, the United States will not give you any money if your ministers don't represent all the people. The United States is doing that just as Israel is not giving the Palestinians any money that they collected from the Palestinians. So that's a monkey see, monkey do. Another quote in a book by John Toland is, mesmerized by his political and military victories, he, as first of a new race of supermen, was bound by none of the conventions of human morality and stood above the law. That's in the book Adolf Hitler, and it sounds just like George Bush. Also, I want to ask, hello?
Yes.
Hello, we're here.
Benjamin Franklin, in his quotes, said a lot of things, but I don't understand what he meant when he said, the devil wipes his behind with poor folks' pride. Do you know what that means?
No, but that's quite an image.
Yeah, that's startling. Mass migrations pale beside that. I do think, though, that it means that I think it has something to do with the banality of evil.
Of evil?
Yes.
Banality of evil. Was poor people?
Well,
because poor people are trapped.
No. Well, if I don't know whether we want to really get into this field of philosophical speculation. I think that the devil being an anthropomorphization of evil in the world, a deep offense to the pride of poor people
May I say something?
Oh, please.
The whole world is involved in a war on terrorism, and they've labeled the Muslims as the evil ones. I think I think Osama bin Laden and the Muslims are wiser than the Americans. And they're not evil.
Well, you'd probably have some argument from people that were involved in the 9/11 thing. But, you know, as you said, the words war on terror, I wish all our media would qualify that with the words, the so-called war on terror. Just as we talk about, you know, the attack on Iraq, the war in Iraq, well, we haven't actually declared war. Congress has not declared war.
Well, the equation,
and,
too.
And I don't know if Hitler declared war on Russia or not, but he was backed by all of Europe, and maybe England, too, and maybe America. Read some of World War II stuff and see what really happened. Oh, one more quote. Neville Chamberlain, at the start of World War II, said, America and the world Jews forced me into the war. And Hitler really liked England. Bye.
Thanks very much for your call. Yes, I believe we do have another caller on the line. Caller, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just trying to tell you that your show's pretty insightful this morning here, and I'd like to give a few more insights.
Thank you. We have a good guest. That's good, one reason. That's what makes it the show.
Good, good sunny days, you know, the last few days with a good solar oven, you may have been able to cook yourself some meals, you know. They're already having rolling blackouts on natural gas in Denver.
Right, right.
So we're there already.
We also, I believe, had a leak of tritium at a nuclear power plant somewhere in the Midwest. I can't remember the name of the city, but a little problem with that.
Oh, really?
Yes.
When did that happen?
On the weekend.
Tritium?
Yes.
Yeah, that just assimilated right into your body as a regular water molecule.
Yes.
It goes right into the... it'll sit there for a while, and then maybe it'll fire off and capture maybe a couple thousand cells within range, you know?
It didn't make it on the mainstream media radar screen, I think, because it would have somewhat put people off their President's Day shopping sprees. Go ahead, though, caller.
That's what I'm talking about, nuclear energy for cooking your food, you know, and it's 90 million miles away, and just use a cardboard box and some glass and aluminum foil in the summertime. That might cover you for 70 days of the year up here in Portland, Oregon area. Hey, the other message, all you folks with the phony landscaping, you know who you are. You're up there in the hills and you have all those security decals around your property. You're using too much water with all those fake plants that don't belong in this bioclimate. We need medicinal plants readily at hand, plants to give us food and building materials. So get rid of all that crap, and the nursery people can help them out by starting to propagate more natural. There's a lot of orphan plants out there, a lot of plants that are rare that need to be brought back.
Well, that's certainly true.
And we got to become indigenous to survive. That's what the Hopi and the Western Shoshone told us. In this land, you'll find out that your Europeanisms don't work, and you'll have to be indigenous like us in the end.
Well,
Keep going.
Yeah, did you have a question, caller? Are you there, caller? Well,
looks like our caller is gone. But I think, you know, if a theme runs through this, it's that people that are kind of that have the mindset that are prepared for this will do okay, or will at least, you know, if you're expecting something, even if it's not something you want to see, but if you're expecting something, you're prepared for it, you'll be a lot better off than the people that are just shocked and kind of wonder, you know, what the hell happened? You know, why aren't my why aren't my fake plants feeding me?
Right.
You know, why isn't my 7,000 square foot house working for me? You know, with the, as the caller said, rolling blackouts in Denver, which is really scary because, you know, they're kind of in the heart of energy country in the United States. They've got, you know, all the coal and natural gas coming down from Canada. If they're having rolling blackouts with natural gas, then a lot of the rest of the country's not too far behind.
Yeah, I would say that. And the caller made an interesting point, too, I thought, about medicinal plants. Actually, practically everything is medicinal in one way or another. It depends on what one would need the medicine for, you know, depending on what you got. There's some plant out there has got the answer to it. Those are graphic and startling images that a lot of the callers have brought up, and I don't know, and I don't think people are really overacting that much. I do think it's necessary to consider working, developing skill sets that are broader and that bear some sort of relationship to the natural environment, whatever shape it takes. And when we say natural, that would be whatever circumstances present us with.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding peak oil and some of the work, just to get back to the topic of the lecture by Kenneth DeFays on the 24th, Beyond Peak Oil. I wanted to ask my guest, who's Peter Schoonmaker with the Illihi Institute. I also wanted to let listeners know that it is 8:32 in the morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. We're your community radio station. And I'm Chris Andre. My guest is Peter Schoonmaker with the Illihi Institute. We're talking about peak oil and all its many ramifications. But we're also talking about some of the rather grim scenarios and some of the rather more positive scenarios this morning. And I do believe we've got another caller. Yes, caller, you're on the air. Good morning.
Hello. I how do you spell the first word of the institute?
It's I-L-L-A-H-E-E.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And what kind of a word is that?
That is, it's a local Chinook jargon word.
I thought it might be something. Anyway, I don't know this peak oil problem. Would growing hemp all over the country help? Because hemp, you can make oil, you can use it in the kitchen. You can make paper, you can make rope, you can make cloth, and I don't know what else. I just wonder if they would get over this closed-mindedness to growing hemp in this country. Maybe that might help with this peak oil problem. Anyway, I'll be listening to people. Goodbye.
Yeah, well,
thank you.
Yeah, hemp is a wonderful plant, and you know, as the caller said, useful for so many things. If we could just get over this kind of whole hemp phobia, you know, I mean, it grows wild along the roadsides of Kansas. I don't know if you've ever driven through Kansas and tried to pull off by the side of the road and roll up some you know, wild cannabis there. Nothing will happen because it has, you know, virtually no THC in it, but. You know, there it is. And so, you know, there's evidence, kind of growing all over roadsides in the Midwest that there's hemp out there that, you know, has basically no psychoactive, component to it. So let me just, take off on that. And, that kind of brings up the issue of, you know, hemp oils and can we use biofuels to, replace some of our oil? And, you know, the answer is, I don't know. But one of the concerns with that is like, you know, we're seeing all these commercials now from GE on the TV saying, you know, green is yellow or go green or go yellow or something. You know, we're going to use corn to power our cars. You know, it takes a lot of fossil fuels. The way our giant agro, farms work is it takes a lot of fossil fuels to grow corn. So it's actually kind of a negative, energy invested on energy return. So you take more energy growing the corn and getting it into a fuel tank than you get energy out. Of course, there's other products that come out of the corn. You know, Bush in his State of the Union talked a little bit about cellulosic fuels, which might help to some degree, but I think most likely what will happen there is that we will use you know, kind of real-time sunlight energy to grow fuels so that we can just power our agriculture. And that's probably the best we can do, because we really don't want to replace food growing with fuel growing. I think we're going to be just pressed just to keep up with our food needs. And so, you know, kind of like pushing aside growing food so that we can power our cars. I think I'd rather power myself than power, you know, my Subaru.
Thanks, caller. I believe we've got another caller. Yes, you are on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, y'all sound like the 60s Back to the Earth gang, you know, that didn't have the advantage of having Mexican slaves that they now have the advantage of having. That's why you don't want to close the borders. But talking about peak oil just helps the oil companies be able to charge more for poor people to have to go to their three jobs that the environmentalists made possible by, you know, everybody has to go offshore because they can't afford, you know, all the to treat all the AIDS and everybody, all the imports from every country in the world, you know, for to get their medical care free, you know, like Americans can't get medical care. It seems like, you know, all this tribalism and company store neighborhoods that you want to develop is just the worst tyranny I've ever heard of.
No one wants to develop it. It's what's being presented. I think that
that's all you talk about is community and neighborhoods and getting back to community.
Okay, caller,
you know,
what's your caller?
Like
caller, what's your solution?
The micro loans that they make, give $5 to somebody in India so they can have, you know, these home businesses where they
you're talking about Ramchi loans, I believe.
Yeah. Caller, what's your vision for the future?
Well, to know the truth about what progressives have actually done. You know, you've enslaved women. You haven't done anything really for women.
Okay,
you don't sound enslaved.
It's like, you know, all the rich women are taking the jobs that regular men used to have.
Okay,
so marriages can't work out because, you know, women that are CEOs aren't going to marry some little peon. You've upset the entire.
Okay, so again, the vision for your vision for the future. What's the way out of this? The enslavement of women, or no, the enslavement of the enslavement of all of us. What's your vision for the future?
Well, send all the people that came here in the '60s from the East Coast back home and take their trust funds with them and let us, you know, have Oregon back. That's my vision for the future. Point out that, you know, it's not nice. It's just like every takeover, every tyrannical takeover, when the East Coast came over here and started taking over the politics and everything. You know, it's no different than genociding the Indians.
Well, I resent that because my great-great-great-grandfather came over here from the East Coast and started taking things over.
Most of the people nowadays that are running things came, you know, in the '60s.
Yeah.
So you're from Oregon, huh?
Well, yeah, you could say that. Yeah. I don't know. I think a lot of the people.
Well, you must be from the kingmakers in Oregon, then.
Oh yeah, and aren't they still running things if they're the kingmakers?
Yeah.
Okay, then. So they didn't come from the East Coast.
Well, yeah. Now Lars Larson is for the guy that, you know, that worked with Neil Goldschmidt, that Lars was complaining about before. I mean, it's the same old, same old.
Yeah. So we've still got this issue that we've peaked in our oil production a couple of months ago, and we got to figure out what to do about it. I mean, regardless
of
whether.
Well, now who says we peaked? The oil companies?
No, the petroleum geologists, the guys that actually know the stuff.
That work for the oil companies.
No, most of the guys that are saying this are guys that have retired.
Maybe it should be that, you know, everybody on the earth, you know, every kid over 13 that has to work, you know, so they can go to rock concerts and buy all the records that they hear on KABU and all the world music and travel, you know, to South America to get their drugs. Or
no, you can get your
Mexico.
Drugs right here in Portland. You have to go to South America. That's what the global, you know, that's globalization. You can buy drugs right on
the
street
right
here.
Right outside the station on
yeah.
that street.
Well, no, to be the source.
Yeah,
you know, it's like going down to the World Social Forum. You know, all these poor people that have the money to go to Italy and then to South America and Mexico and all around the 33 countries. Most of the people that call in that say they're poor people are always talking about all their world travels.
Yeah, well,
I mean, that's the poor people that want to. But say they're poor, but they're really, you know, just pretending, and they want to get back to the land with Mexican slaves.
Right. Well, you know, I love ridiculing myself as much as the next person, but still, what do we do about this problem? Would you say that it's that basically all this, you know, kind of localization and kind of regional economy stuff is crap, and that what we need, like, kind of central government control? I mean, what's the answer here? Do we need George Bush and large corporations telling us what to do?
Subsidize local CSAs.
Yeah. So what
you
are
know,
we? What
the
should
the city of Portland, so yeah. the rich people can have organic food while the rest of us, you know, get whatever's left.
Well, you can,
after you steal our,
you can grow your own. You can,
yeah,
right. You can grow your own organic
PVC
food. So
scams.
Okay, I'm still not hearing a lot of solutions. I'm just hearing a lot of ridicule, which is fine. I enjoy ridicule, but that's always fun. But again, what
I
do we do?
The solution is to point out that you people are pickpockets. That you're not helping anybody but yourselves, and
caller,
you help yourself about everything that former Oregonians used to own,
caller,
including their pride.
Caller, I have a question for you. What is the source
you
of your
from Oxford?
What
have a question for pee on me?
Actually, I was born in St. Vincent's Hospital in Portland, Oregon.
I thought you went.
My
to
question,
Oxford.
Caller. My well, only for a year. I did classics. My question is, what is the source of what is the source of your information? Where do you get this information from? What is your source? Tell me your source.
The source of my information?
No, yeah. Where do you get the information
from?
Well,
I got some of it in the Oregonian, you know, about the takeovers of our neighborhood. I've watched the neighborhood.
What neighborhood was taken over?
You know, change from the 60s. I've
well,
watched,
no, wait. A neighborhood can't be
I've
taken over by the 60s.
I've watched how they've changed.
Neighborhoods cannot be taken over by the 60s. The 60s was an era in American history. Neighborhoods can
Buckland
be taken over
taken
by...
taken over by...
What
you
is
know,
your source?
People that came from everywhere else. Northwest Portland, Terwilliger.
And where do you live? What sort of work do you do? Where do you live? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, why would I do that?
Well, because I'm asking you.
Well, it's none of your business. I would tell everybody in Portland.
Well, you know a great deal about
anybody.
You seem to know a great deal about
your
us.
Business because they're out to pickpocket you.
Well, you seem knowledgeable about us, so we wanted you to. We wondered if you would like to share a little vignette of your own life.
I just told you I've walked through neighborhoods. I've watched them, you know, as they eliminated all the regular people that lived there and got PDC loans to gentrify about every inner city neighborhood there is. And now you're working on North Portland.
Us
you're
personally?
Taking over, you're gentrifying, you're the ones that are gentrifying it, but you have, you know, the very people that are complaining about gentrification over there actually working with you.
Boy, if
so you kind of wonder what in the world is going on.
You know, if you saw this studio, you wouldn't acclaim us, you wouldn't, you know, accuse us of gentrification, I can guarantee you that. So, you know, but, you know, caller, I think you've got some valid
your
points
studio,
in that.
Oh, God.
It's not my studio, it's a studio
that
I happen
with
to.
Anything? And the, it's your studio? What happens when, as a nonprofit, what happens to all these nonprofits?
You're welcome. Come
you
down
know,
anytime you like.
When they go
like.
Out of business, when they can't, when the Rockefellers and Carnegies and Fords and Pews and all those people aren't going to give you funds anymore.
We don't get funds
what
from
happen- them. Do you just split it up between yourselves, or what happens to all the assets?
We have no idea since we don't get any money from those corporations. Thank
Bye.
You very much, caller. Thank you so much.
Barbara Bernstein doesn't get grants from, like, Robert Wood Johnson?
You might want to ask. I don't, you know, ask her.
You better keep track.
You want to come? You can come down and have a look for yourself anytime. We'd welcome you. Thank you, caller. Do we have another caller on the line? Good morning, caller. You're on the air.
So here's a clear example of uneducated society, and this is the consciousness that roams and runs this country. It's completely. She has no clue what the heck is she talking about, and. She's going to be the ones that she's going to be the people that are going to suffer. And I Cabo doesn't get any money except for from the people that try to support it. And I think she's actually probably somebody that's a plant by somebody, some nonprofit Republican side or whatever they are. And they're coming in to cloud the issue and to create hate, and that's what they feed on.
I think even that the Republicans can afford better material than that, actually.
Oh, my, I think they do, and she is a clear case of
we
what...
We like her, though. We welcome all callers.
Yeah, I thought, you know...
Well, right, and we're here to educate them, but the only reason I'm calling is I wanted to talk to Peter. Peter, what's your last name?
Schoonmaker.
And how do we get a hold of you?
You can just, if you...
Because I have a show in town I want you to come on as a guest with 150 hours of reruns.
If you just get a hold of us at our office at Illahi, the phone number is 503-222-2537.
2537?
Yep.
All right, and the last thing is there's that caller that called about the plants. Everybody's growing plants that don't feed us. They actually were probably poisonous before they fed us around in the rich area and around. Everybody does it, poor and rich. They plant plants because they look pretty. And that caller just like three callers ago.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if he's listening, I would like to talk to him because he is very smart and he has a lot of things to talk about, nuclear isotopes that float in the air and
right.
that are in their dust. And that's what a lot of the things that we're getting sick from is from the nuclear. And the last thing is growing hemp. 1 acre of hemp will grow 1 ton of seed. 1 ton of seed will create 300 gallons of heating oil. Plus the byproduct of making the heating oil is hemp meal. And you can grow your food. But here's the problem. We live in a carbon era, and that's what's killing us.
Mm-hmm.
Burning and cutting down our trees is what's killing us. And burning coal is what's killing us. The carbon era must stop. But here's another thing, is if you go biodiesel, if you go corn, you're going to have a problem. Guess what they're going to do?
Genetically modified.
They're going to start cutting all the trees down, and they're going to start tearing up all the land, and they're going to start growing monocropping. And they're going to be shoving in mass amounts of nitrogen, which we've already got a problem with, that are creating huge nitrogen blooms in our lakes and rivers. So you have to do it sustainably and economically, and you have to do it right. We can't keep planting houses on top of our crop fields. And we can't keep cutting down the trees. We must use the land we have now and prevent the people from building on them. And if they do, we must tax the heck out of them or make them pay to take our food land away. Because if we keep doing the carbon, we're all going to die. That's it.
Yeah. Well, we're all going to die anyway.
well, I'd like to die with a smile on my face.
Yeah.
At least know that I made an effort in
yeah.
my own world instead of everybody else's.
Right.
Because if I can be a beacon of light, a warrior of light in a dark space, and allow that light to shimmer on into the people that just called, like this lady, and see that it is truly economical and viable to do this on your own part, then I will have done my job in this world.
Yeah.
So.
And not to beat a dead horse, but you know, I think if that woman was a plant from the right wing, some right wing, you know, from a right wing Republican, you know, interest group, or
like Lars Larson,
like Lars or some, there's many of them. But even if she was, I think some of the changes that she's, you know, that she is decrying, I think she has some legitimate gripes that Portland has changed and maybe she doesn't like the way it's changed, and that's a legitimate gripe. But you know, kind of the manner of the discourse there was, you know, such classic kind of Rush Limbaugh, where you kind of talk over people and you
yeah.
just, you never even give them, all you do is ridicule. And as you could hear several times, we said, okay, so what's the solution? And her solution was, if I remember, is to, further ridicule, is to point out how awful you are. And it's like, no, how are we going to solve this? Basically, you know, biogeophysical problem of we're running out of stuff to burn. And so what do we do about that? And again, the solution came up, well, to ridicule you guys is that's the solution, but without ever letting us even talk,
she'll be the first in the food line. And you
yeah.
know what? We're just a Guatemala and a Costa Rica. The
yeah.
corporations have done what they did to them. They've done to us now.
Mm-hmm.
We're only 250 million people. We are worthless. Ford is making $1 billion in China, but they're bankrupt in the United States. They have taken all of our resources, just like Colombia and Costa Rica and Central America, and now they've moved offshore to be predators and parasites on another civilization. But here's the thing. We are all slave owners when we purchase our products from a red country, like a bad slave country. I mean, China's slavery, period. It's pure and simple. It's communist. And now we're buying all of our products from that. So we must look within ourselves to make changes, and then that light will shine upon everybody else, and it is infective. That light will infect you like a cancer. So buy made in the USA, support our local governments, support our local people with your dollar. Thank you.
Thanks, caller. And I think we're coming up to the top of the hour, 9 o'clock. It's 8:52 right now. We've got time for a couple more callers if we can make, if the callers would be willing to make their remarks brief. Yes, hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I think there's going to be a peak oil conference today at PSU beginning at 3 o'clock. I think it's from 3 to 9 on oil, globalization, and the war. I wanted to focus on affluenza, the sickness of affluenza, and our wastefulness. Somewhere I read that more energy is consumed on a weekend in Las Vegas than the whole Northeast uses in an entire month. You know, once upon a time, there was a technology assessment office, and the government used its power, you know, to promote labor-friendly and environmental-friendly industries. You know, we are a country that does research on limits of growth, but we don't have any political will, you know, to really act out sustainable lifestyles. One resource that I recommend would be adbusters.com and their campaign to teach economists to subtract, you know, to so that nuclear weapons
has been updated.
Traffic accidents are counted as negative in the gross domestic product. I'm wondering if you'd comment on our affluenza, on the fact that we are 5% of the Earth's people and we're using up 25% of the oil and the resources. And that alternatives, while they're repressed by the media, do exist. Alternatives of sustainability and subsistence economics.
You know, it's you know, we've known that statistic, you know, 5% of the world's population and 25, 23, 27% of the world's kind of consumption for 30 years or more, and it's scandalous, and we hear it and kind of go, it's great, it's wonderful. What do we do about that? I mean, it seems that we're pretty happy being 5% of the world's population and consuming a quarter of the world's resources. I don't know. That's it should be a scandal, and yet that's just the way the world is.
Asking you know, the general American public to cut back on consumption has historically not been a winning idea, and I think that is a big problem.
Yes, when Jimmy Carter put on a sweater and turned down the thermostat, I guess he antagonized the energy industry, the oil industries.
And that, and in many other ways, yes, probably. I think we've got time for just caller. Do you, I want to thank you for your comments, and I'd like to see if we can fit just a couple more people in. Yes, good morning, caller. You're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah.
Hello.
Good morning.
Welcome.
Thank you. Peter, I moved here to Oregon in the 70s and worked in the housing industry all through the 80s and watched Portland's homes, the older ones that, you know, there are people who say were gentrified, get storm windows and insulation and have their energy costs and become more comfortable and more valuable, you know. But while the people all across the country were abandoning the inner city and homes like these or raising them to put up apartments. So I don't consider our cost of living unjustified in that, you know, living standards are becoming higher. So I see solutions. You know, I do see solutions happening. I think I think there's really no way to cut down energy consumption with transportation, that we have to plan our communities so that we can walk in them more, bicycle safely, structure mass transit, and reorder what suburbia was built into something more locally oriented. And those are important solutions that I think people could maybe not find my, you know, the way I try to explain it, but maybe someone a little more charismatic could explain that the solutions are exciting, positive, and we'll be driving a lot less in the future. But you know, just like Portland's water system, you know, the Bull Run sheltered water system comes in here, comes out beautiful. Why couldn't that solution be replicated all around the world? So I'd like to hear, you know, more solutions.
Yeah, I agree, caller. We, you know, there are a lot of positive things we can do, and it's a matter of can we do those things in the face of kind of big global forces that kind of wash over us.
Right. And see, I don't see President Bush as really a solution. He's not looking at solutions. He's talking, but I think he's really a malevolent character, all the Bushes, and I think he's preventing solutions from happening.
I have no idea what that guy is thinking.
Yeah, right.
No. I think he's
think of those positive solutions and give people something to work forward. You know, look forward to as a way of to build the future better.
Thank you, caller. And I want to also thank everybody that called in this morning with their comments and their questions. Thanks for participating. That's what makes it community radio. And I especially want to thank my guest this morning, Peter Schoonmaker of the Illahi Institute. There is a wonderful, the Illahi Institute is presenting a wonderful lecture series. Last year they did a really great one, How Cities Learn. This year it is Oil and Water. On the 24th of this month, Kenneth DeFays is going to be talking about peak oil. And we want to encourage everybody that's listening and to come out and go to the lecture, find out more about this very important topic. Right now it is 8:59 a.m. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon, your community radio station. I'm Chris Andre. Thanks very much for listening.